Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. At 9:30 and 10:30 this morning, we're going to hear from a couple of members of the governor's cabinet to discuss how the state's ARPA funds might be utilized. At 10, we'll check in with national correspondent Bob Ney, and we'll then hear from Colin Flanders of 7 Days about a Ukraine connection that several newspapers in Vermont have. But let's begin the show expanding a subject we spoke about a few weeks ago. Linda Radke joined us to talk about a piece she had written for the Montpelier Bridge about the women-owned businesses right here on Stowe Street in Waterbury. Now I'd like to look further afield at women-owned businesses throughout the state of Vermont. Joining me to discuss the topic is Meg Smith, the director of Vermont Women's Fund. Meg, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Always a pleasure to be here.
Great having you. And we also have Connie Mendel. She's the owner of the Linen Shop in Rochester. Connie, thank you for being here as well.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Great having you. Now, listeners, to ask our guests a question or to share a woman-owned business in Vermont, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Meg, explain what the Vermont Women's Fund is.
The Vermont Women's Fund is the first philanthropic resource, funding source, for the state of Vermont to support women and girls solely, specifically. And it was started 28 years ago with the idea that there were very few programs at that time that were really focused on empowering women. And when I say empowering women, I mean helping women achieve economic self-sufficiency. So that funding source began many years ago, and over the years as an organization, we've matured and grown not only larger in the size of our fund and the money that we have, but also really honed in specifically on a lot of programs that we know help women achieve success.
Now, I know you haven't been there 28 years, but since you have been involved, what have we seen in as far as growth in the number of women-owned businesses in Vermont?
Well, you just hit the nail on the head, Rick, because we don't know how many women-owned businesses there are in the state. And this was just a simple oversight when it comes to collecting data. The Secretary of State, as you know, if you start a business, you have to get a license from the Secretary of State's office. And they issued licenses without ever asking, do you identify as a man or a woman for your business? So the Secretary of State's office knows that there are 81,132 businesses in the state, but we don't know how many are owned by men or by women.
Wow.
And the reason why that's important is that traditionally women have always had a harder time getting funding, loans, credit. That just the financial doors have been closed to women up until the last, I'm going to say 30 years, which is perhaps being generous.
Mm-hmm.
I know a man had to co-sign for a woman to get a credit card. The law didn't change till the 70s that a man had to co-sign with her in order to get a credit card. So those kinds of old structures have now disappeared. And we know women have been running businesses in Vermont for many, many years, for centuries, in mm-hmm. fact. But we don't know who they are, and we don't know how many there are.
Well, out of those 81,132, we do know of at least one women-owned business, and that is the Linen Shop in Rochester, owned by Connie Mendel. Connie, tell us about your business, the Linen Shop. What does your business do?
It services mostly weddings, but also any special event industry that's going on in Vermont. We rent tablecloths like a rental company, but our focus is specifically linens for events.
Now, this seems like a very niche business, but apparently a niche that needed to be filled. How and why did you get started in it?
That is the exact reason. I had owned a catering company, and I had been catering for maybe 10 years or so, and I saw this need. I looked to local rental companies, and quite frankly, I wasn't impressed with my options. I had been a seamstress, so I decided to make my own line of rental linens and offer them to my catering clients, and it just grew from there.
Wow. Do you still do any catering?
Well, we did up until this little thing called COVID.
Right.
The timing was such that I had been thinking about retiring or selling the company, and then COVID hit, and quite frankly, I didn't have the oomph to reinvent myself. I think to survive during COVID would have been a huge challenge, and I decided to just switch gears and focus solely on the linens.
Connie, when you started this 25 years ago, I would imagine your options were white, beige, and maybe some other color as far as linens. I was to your website. How many different color options and patterns do you offer at the linen shop?
I think we're up to almost 400. I want to say 397 or something like that. So, and, you know, invariably, whatever we have, somebody wants something else. So we're continually.
That's great. Meg, I wish we reached a point when it wasn't something out of the ordinary to have women-owned businesses, that this wasn't a topic of discussion. But why is it still important to highlight these businesses and find ways to foster their creation and growth?
One of the things we learned, Rick, in doing our research a couple of years ago, and we had to use census data, the U.S. Census Business Owner Survey, in order to get some wrap our arms around numbers of women-owned businesses. And at that time, we learned there are over 23,000 women-owned businesses in the state, that women were starting businesses at a very fast pace. There was a lot of growth, but the bottom line was the revenues were 19 cents to the dollar of a male-owned business. Mm. And that's a huge gap. And I won't go too deep into it, except that women were not growing their businesses at the same rate. So it wasn't just revenues, dollars to dollars. It was also growth. They had a solo business. They never hired an employee or employees, et cetera. So that 19 cents to the dollar, that's what we looked at and said, how can we grow that? We don't need to create anything new. We have this strong base of women-owned businesses, but how do we help them grow? How do we support them? So we decided to launch an initiative called This Way Up. There's power in our numbers. And it's a website and survey where we can get women-owned businesses to be counted and identified. And then from there, we are learning a lot of what their needs are, what they're looking for, and how we can support that. So I'll just fill in and say, you know, 29% of our respondents so far say they're looking for industry connections. 23% are looking for introductions to potential clients. So there are all these very basic business needs that are no different than a male-owned business, but because they we're in a rural state, they live in rural pockets around Vermont, it's harder to make those industry connections. So that's one thing we're talking about, what we can do. But the important part right now is building this database of women-owned businesses. So anyone who has a full-time business, part-time, maybe a side hustle, they're just bringing a little income on the side with the idea of maybe they could grow that into a real business, we would love to have them go to our survey, thiswayupvt.com, and sign up and be counted.
Now, Connie, 25 years ago, you start the linen shop. Even before that, the catering business. So Meg has mentioned barriers that women faced getting businesses started. Did you face certain barriers, and can you tell us about those when you started your businesses?
Absolutely. And this thing about needing your husband to co-sign, they may have changed the laws in the 70s, but that doesn't mean they changed the practices. The last time I bought a car a few years ago, they wanted my husband's name on it. And I've been established in business all these years. So, yes, there were those financial obstacles. One of my biggest obstacles was my location. You know, if I wanted to be a multi-million dollar company, I would not be located in central Vermont.
Right.
I chose to live here first and raise my family here and then start my business. So, you know, I was working with the cards I was dealt. But I think when you're in rural Vermont, you have to work that much harder. My term is guerrilla marketing. You know, I started the company on a shoestring, and I did everything I could think of to get my name out there.
Yeah. And Connie is located in Rochester. Lovely town. I really love it. But, you know, you have to wind around a mountain to get to an interstate. It's not the closest to any really big population centers. So I completely understand, you know,
we
that.
We think of ourselves as being at the hub of the wheel.
Yeah.
And so we deliver linens, you know, north, south, east, west, in every direction. Unfortunately, there's a mountain in between the hub and the rim of that
That's
wheel.
That's right. Indeed, there is. Meg, how does the Vermont Women's Fund help new women-owned businesses get started?
Our job right now, because we are a funder and give out grants to nonprofits that support women and girls around the state, our job right now is to identify and count the women-owned businesses. We're building a database. Once that database is built, the sky's the limit in terms of how we can create networks of support, possible microloans. There's a lot of great ideas, but I don't want to jump ahead because really our number one goal is to count. Our goal is to count at least 10,000 women-owned businesses in the state by the end of the year. So that's why I'm going to keep asking you to talk about women going to the survey at thiswayupvt.com.
Sure.
And taking the survey. And that's our number one goal. But can I add something else here, which is,
you may,
you know, the timing of this initiative and this thinking around women-owned businesses couldn't be better because we're coming out of the pandemic. One out of every four women in Vermont had to leave their jobs or voluntarily left the workforce or were forced to for reasons of child care, elder care, you name it. And there are a lot of women and men right now reinventing themselves. They are thinking, what's important to me? And entrepreneurship is on the rise across the country. It's one of the things the pandemic has done. It's really forced people to look at their quality of life and what they want out of life. And so many people, so many smart, entrepreneurial thinking people are saying, hey, I can start a business. I can do this. And so we want to support all of them, but particularly women, with the tools and the information that they need. But first, we have to find out who they are.
Yeah.
So that's our number one goal, is identification. After that, we have wonderful technical assistance programs across the state through the Small Business, SBDC, Small Business Development Corp.
Who will be on the show this Monday with us, as a matter of fact.
Oh, super.
Yep.
Oh, great. I'll listen.
Good.
And we know that when women succeed, so do their communities. The research is very clear. 90% of a woman's income goes right back into the local community because they're supporting more often than not families, and they are supporting communities. They give back. Their businesses give. 97% of our respondents say that they give back to their communities in donations or in-kind services.
Connie,
there's a huge potential.
Yeah. Connie Mendel, how were you able to launch your business, the Linen Shop, back in the 90s? Did it help that you already had a catering business?
Absolutely. Both of my businesses fed each other. Mm-hmm. You know, people would call us for catering, and we'd ask if they needed linens, and they'd call to order linens, and we'd say, do you have a caterer yet? So I think aligning yourself with a particular industry or, you know, somebody else in the business, so you're not necessarily designing that customer base by yourself.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the pandemic earlier, and that was the end of your catering business. You rely on events. So how has that impacted the Linen Shop business over these last 2 years?
There definitely was a pause, and, you know, I was so grateful for grant money and monies that were available through the state for people in business, not just women, anyone in business who was struggling during the pandemic. That was a godsend. But we just, you know, hung in there, and last year was busy, and 2022 looks like it could be off the charts.
Oh, that's great to hear. Want to mention again before we go to the phones, thiswayupvt.com. If you do have or know of a women-owned business, that's where you can go to fill out a survey. Very helpful to the Vermont Women's Fund. Let's go to Fred, who joins us from Newbury. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Morning.
Good morning.
I worked for a woman. She had a man's business. She had four men working for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked part-time for her, and sometimes we had to do a service call at night. It was a restaurant service business, so we had to do work after the restaurant was closed down.
Sure.
So we'd report to work at 5 o'clock, right after the day was over, and she would give us the assignment. Sometimes it would take an hour to get to the job. So she said, there's a lot of nice restaurants in the town, and I want you guys to go have a sit-down supper tonight, and don't worry about the price. And she gave us the company credit card. We go do the work. And then every once in a while, she decided that she wanted to take everybody to Boston to go to a fancy restaurant in Boston for lunch.
Hey, Fred, I want to get back to my guest, but when would this have been? About what years would this have been that you
would? Oh, let's see. If you take 15, say you take 17 years from today, that's when it ended, because she sold the business
back
about 17
in the
years ago.
All right. Great.
I'm not good at arithmetic.
That's all right. She finished up about 2005. So we're talking about probably the 80s, 90s, into the early 2000s. Meg Smith, I want to know, you know, why you think it is important to foster the development, the growth of women-owned businesses in Vermont, and how you are going to use the information that you glean from the survey at thiswayupvt.com.
Our job at the Women's Fund is to really bridge this gap of making visible what is now currently invisible. Without knowing the number of women-owned businesses and their financial contribution to the state, we're in the dark, and we are thus then invisible. And so hearing voices and stories like Connie's, knowing how many women, just what Fred described, a woman business owner. Those stories are so powerful because not only do they help encourage other women to say, hey, I can do this and there's help out there or I'll find help, but it's really the bottom line, Rick, is building Vermont's economy. If we can get those revenues of women-owned businesses from 19 cents up to a dollar for dollar, think how much money that's bringing into the state. That's billions of dollars. So just closing that gap is going to be a major accomplishment. But I also know there's so many women out there with great ideas, and they're unsure of how to proceed, or they don't want to take the risk of getting of going into debt and taking a loan. But that loan would jumpstart them into a much faster growth model than if they're waiting to slowly build their business with their savings. So the end goal is to get Vermont up and running, up to speed with the women-owned businesses making the same kind of money as all our great male-owned businesses.
Connie, we've got about a minute left. You have launched two successful businesses in Rochester, Vermont. So what advice do you have for women who are considering starting their own business?
You know, sometimes people ask me how I got started and what my motivation was. And for me personally, I was a rebel, and I didn't want to go to college. I couldn't see myself in a 9-to-5 job, but there's no right reason. It's your reason. And, you know, you just don't second guess yourself. Don't say, oh, I don't have what it takes, because being an entrepreneur takes the same skills of being good at any job. It's hard work, focus, responsibility. Do what you say you're going to do, and you'll succeed.
What was the most delicious thing you made, you know, in your catering business?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here. My favorite thing was bringing all the leftovers home after the event to feeding my family.
Best answer ever. Well done, Connie. That is Connie Mendel.
You know, Rick, he's always about food.
Always about food. This is the truth. Connie Mendel is the owner of the Linen Shop in Rochester. Meg Smith, the director of the Vermont Women's Fund. And again, the survey you can fill out, women business owners, thiswayupvt.com. Thank you both for being on the show this morning.
Thank you so
much.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll be back with the Agency of Natural Resources Secretary Julie Moore. And coming up today at 1 o'clock on WDEV, we've got Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Dr. Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. Vermont has received ARPA funds from the federal government totaling $1.25 billion that can be used to address a number of needs in the state. Governor Phil Scott has determined how he'd like to see the money utilized. Earlier this week, we discussed how he sees housing needs being addressed. And a little later this morning, we'll take a look at business and economic development. But now we're going to see how the governor would like to address climate change mitigation and water and sewer needs. Joining me to explain that is Vermont's Agency of Natural Resources Secretary Julie Moore. Secretary Moore, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Always a pleasure.
Good morning. Listeners, if you've got a question for Secretary Julie Moore or thoughts on how you'd like to see these ARPA funds used, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Secretary Moore, give us an overview of the areas the Agency of Natural Resources is responsible for.
Sure, I'd be happy to. We'll start by talking a little bit about water infrastructure, which includes both our drinking water and wastewater systems. And these are obviously incredibly important to modern life, but also often out of sight and out of mind. And so these ARPA dollars present an incredible opportunity to invest and reinvest in this critical infrastructure. The governor's budget includes a range of initiatives, including improving stormwater management, helping construct wastewater treatment systems, community scale systems, in jurisdictions that don't currently have one. We know there are about 150 village centers in downtown areas across the state of Vermont that currently are not served by a public sewer system, and that is, it can be a damper on growth. There are also investments related to addressing flood-prone properties, improving our pretreatment program, which helps municipal wastewater facilities manage commercial and industrial wastewater, breweries and distilleries, dairy processing and meat processing facilities tend to produce some really high strength waste. That can be a challenge. And then the only option to those entities is to move to a larger wastewater system. And then some direct grants to low income Vermonters to address failed or failing water and wastewater systems associated with residential properties and manufactured home communities. It's a really exciting package. It's work we started during this current fiscal year and are looking to grow and build out in the over the next several fiscal years with these ARPA dollars.
Now, I know we're going to focus on two major areas that are under your purview, climate change mitigation and water and sewer. How much would the governor like to see allocated for climate change mitigation? How much for these water and sewer projects?
So the water and sewer projects received an initial allocation from the legislature last year of $100 million, and the governor is seeking an additional $72 million for a total of $172. When it comes to climate action, there was about $30 million that was allocated last year, and the governor's recommended budget includes over $215 million in additional ARPA investments, looking at things like weatherization, transportation electrification, and some investments in our working in natural lands to build resilience at the landscape scale.
Now, what are the greatest concerns that you see affecting the state because of climate change?
Well, certainly hazards, flood hazards, chief among them, are one of the most significant issues. We know that Vermont's development tends to be concentrated in our river valleys, and thinking back to Tropical Storm Irene, but also a number of significant flood, more localized, but equally significant flood events that have taken place since. We know that infrastructure is at risk. And so making investments to try to move existing structures out of harm's way to the extent it makes sense, ensure our bridges and culverts are able to pass what we know will be higher flood flows in the future. And then also looking for areas, green spaces to maintain, to allow rivers to sort of come out of their banks intentionally, and ideally away from investments we may have made on the landscape, is going to be really important.
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to drive down greenhouse gas emissions, and weatherization is a really key strategy in that space. Reducing the amount of fossil fuels Vermonters need to keep their homes warm during the winter, and then ultimately supporting them in making the shift from fossil fuel burning furnaces to things like all-electric heat pumps is sort of a 1-2 approach that will really help reduce Vermont's greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, another way that we're fighting to do that would be with electric vehicles. And I know
Correct. There's
a couple things I'll group together that are in this proposal: EV infrastructure and transportation electrification incentives. So how much would be allocated for each of these, and how would that money be used?
The governor's recommended $37 million worth of overall investment in transportation electrification, and this would then be coupled with an additional $20 million Vermont is slated to receive as part of the federal infrastructure package, also for transportation electrification. We know that there are a lot of folks out there that are interested in potentially purchasing an electric vehicle, but are challenged by what some term range anxiety, just mm-hmm. that there isn't enough charging infrastructure spread broadly across the landscape right now to allow Vermonters to feel confident that if they head out in an electric vehicle, they'll find a place to charge it that's conveniently located to their destination and will allow them to make the return trip back. And so the state, I think, has a leading role to play in making some of these investments in publicly available charging infrastructure to help ensure that Vermonters can feel confident should they choose to purchase an electric vehicle.
With these investments in the infrastructure, in the incentives, do you have an idea of how many gas-powered vehicles we would be able to replace with EVs here in Vermont?
I mean, we have targets, and frankly, one of the challenges at this point right now is I think a challenge people are seeing in a lot of spaces around supply chain, and just having the electric vehicles for sale in Vermont may be the most significant limiting factor at this point. The ARPA monies are time limited. They need to be fully expended by the end of calendar year 2026, but they really need to be committed to individual projects, and I think that would include individual incentive payments to Vermonters by the end of 2024. And at least currently, we're really struggling to have electric vehicles for sale here in Vermont, and I anticipate that may be the case for a considerable portion of the time these ARPA dollars are available to us.
You mentioned weatherization. First of all, how much would be allocated if the governor's wishes were accepted, and who would be eligible for those funds?
So the governor has recommended a total $80 million investment in weatherization. This is a fairly dramatic scaling of the investments that take place currently. These incentives would be made available to both low and moderate income Vermonters. And would focus on reducing heat loss, knowing we have a lot of older housing stock here in Vermont, sealing them up, things like insulating people's attics, changing out their windows, and ensuring the airtight nature of the structure. The different programs would be administered through different entities, with work being led by the Office of Economic Opportunity and the Department of Children and Families, for low-income Vermonters, and then through Efficiency Vermont for moderate-income Vermonters.
Another line item is the hazard mitigation buyouts. So explain what that would be and why these are needed.
Sure. So we know that historically development didn't always consider the potential for flooding when different structures were put up, both homes and businesses. And there has been opportunities through FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to offer building owners buyouts at different points in time throughout Vermont's history. But not every flood-prone structure has been eligible for a FEMA buyout for a myriad of bureaucratic reasons. The governor's budget includes $15 million specifically targeting some of those harder-to-reach places and helping homeowners have an economically viable opportunity to get out of their flood-prone home or commercial building. In addition, the governor has included in his budget $10 million in one-time general fund money that we will be able to use to bring additional FEMA resources to bear. The state of Vermont receives a small fraction of its overall FEMA funding each year in the form of hazard mitigation grants. But as a result of the COVID pandemic, we're going to have the opportunity to access significantly more FEMA dollars than we have in any prior year since Irene. And the governor's $10 million general fund commitment would allow us to match those dollars and take full advantage of that opportunity.
Julie, before we leave climate mitigation, have you seen any positive movements by the legislature so far on how you'd like to see those ARPA funds used?
We have. I've been invited into a number of different committees in the legislature to provide an overview. As your listeners may recall, the legislature passed what has been called the Global Warming Solutions Act back in 2019. It formed the Vermont Climate Council. The Vermont Climate Council issued its initial action plan back in December of this past year. And the governor's recommendations really align fairly closely with the priority investments identified by the Climate Council. And so have spoken at length with committees about that important nexus and how this supports the implementation of the Global Warming Solutions Act.
All right. Let's now focus on water and sewer. And again, I'd like to step back, get a global picture of why funds are needed here, the effects on our environment if they're not addressed.
Sure. We know that as a state, we have almost $2 billion in unmet water infrastructure needs that will likely need to be funded over the next 10 years. This includes everything from investments in existing wastewater collection and drinking water systems, addressing sewer overflows, improving stormwater management, addressing some dam safety improvements, both at state and privately owned dam facilities, as well as at the homeowner scale, looking at the same kinds of infrastructure as they relate to manufactured home communities or even individual single-family residents. So the need is really significant. This is an important, not only environmental concern, but also a public health issue. Inadequately treated wastewater can have real significant impacts on human health.
Well, in the individual homes, I think it's under an allocation for something called Healthy Homes. So tell us what that is, how the money would be used.
Sure. It's providing direct grants or rebates to individual single-family homeowners. This is one of the most exciting initiatives from my perspective, and it fills an unmet need. It's something we've known has been a problem, particularly for low-income Vermonters whose wells may be failing over time and no longer yielding enough water to meet the demands of their household, or whose septic systems have gone past the end of their useful life and begun to fail. Our programs that we generally administer that provide funding are really designed with municipalities in mind. And because more than half of Vermonters are served by these on-site individual systems, the tools in our toolbox have been fairly limited. We announced the availability of this grant program or the application period of this grant program just a week ago today and have already received more than 300 applications from individual Vermont homeowners interested in some amount of financial assistance to support their efforts to replace their either drinking water well or on-site wastewater system.
Now, the largest amount requested in this water and sewer section is for stormwater retrofits. So how much are you asking? How would this be used? What's the problem that it would solve?
Sure. So in FY22 budget, there was $10 million put towards these stormwater retrofits, and the governor is recommending an additional $32 million as part of this FY23 budget. Stormwater retrofits are a central type of effort that's required to achieve our water quality goals for Lake Champlain and to meet the commitments we've made to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in terms of reducing phosphorus pollution. And this money would be used to work with landowners on the engineering designs needed to better manage stormwater runoff from their sites, as well as provide cost share to support the construction of the practices that will be necessary to meet our obligations with EPA.
And then combined sewer overflow abatement, another area you'd like to address. How big a problem is that in the state?
Well, the number of communities that are served by what we call combined sewer systems, which are some of our oldest sewer systems and were actually designed to carry stormwater and wastewater in a single pipe, is in the neighborhood of only about 10 systems statewide. But during periods of significant rainfall or snow melt, those systems can surcharge and overflow without treatment. And we know that this is a public health concern in addition to a broader water quality issue. The challenge is dealing with a system that now runs under roads and homes and buildings. It can be complicated and expensive. We know that there's more than $60 million worth of needs that have been identified statewide to reduce the frequency and intensity of these overflow events. And between the governor's recommendations for this current year, coupled with money that's being invested currently, we believe we can dramatically accelerate efforts to reduce sewer overflows. Most communities have a 20-year long-term plan to eliminate those overflows. And we believe that we could accomplish as much as half of the work required to achieve those long-term goals.
Like I asked about the climate change mitigation allocations, what feedback have you received so far from the legislature on these water and sewer requests?
Broad support. Obviously, water quality has been an area of priority for both the governor and the legislature throughout the 5 years I've been fortunate enough to be in this position. Mm-hmm. And I would say the ARPA investments have been no exception. The legislature actually went so far as to sort of program ahead a little bit of money last year. The governor's request had been $40 million, and they committed a total of $100 million in the FY22 budget so that ANR would have the assurance that not only did we have resources for year one of these initiatives, but would have resources to bring to bear for year two. And then the governor's funding recommendation for FY23 would really round that out and see some pretty transformational investments in our communities and to the benefit of individual property owners as well.
Secretary, we did have a caller who couldn't stay on the line, wanted to know who they can call about replacing a septic system. I would imagine that's individual home, so that would be the Healthy Homes program. Is there a number they can call to learn more about applying for that money?
Sure. So we've put together a website, which is probably the best place to go, and that address is anr.vermont.gov/content/ARPA, which is ARPA-Vermont. And on that page, there each of the different initiatives I've described are presented in a little bit more detail. But if folks click on the individual drinking water and wastewater system link, there's an opportunity to fill out a form and someone will follow up. Alternatively, that you are able to call 802-760-9967 with questions, and we will be sure to direct you to the right person within the staff team.
Okay, and we have about 45 seconds left. When I spoke with Commissioner Josh Hanford the other day about housing, he stressed that timing was critical in getting the funds approved for these projects. So is it the same with the projects that we've discussed today?
It absolutely is. While we have till the end of calendar year 24 to encumber these dollars to commit them to projects, the governor has asked the legislature to appropriate the full balance in this current fiscal year so that we'll be able to plan for those investments. 2024 in some ways feels a ways away, but the reality of it is when you're talking about the types of capital projects that are envisioned here, we need as much planning runway as possible.
Absolutely. I'll give that website address and phone number again, anr.vermont.gov/content/ARPA/Vermont, the phone number 802-760-9967. Julie Moore is the Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources. Secretary Moore, thank you so much for being on this morning.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All right, take care. And at 10:30, Department of Economic Development Commissioner Joan Goldstein joins us to continue this discussion on ARPA funds. We've got Bob Ney up next, and don't forget this afternoon, 4 o'clock, the afternoon news service, Brady Farkas show at 5:30, and then jazz with George Thomas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. The world has been complicated enough over the past 2 years, so it's great to have national correspondent Bob Ney to check in with to get some perspective on what's happening each week. And Bob is with us now. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Bob, let's start with the COVID numbers.
Right. Statistically, worldwide, 6,033,000 have passed. And in America, a great portion, 964,000. I mean, we're going to hit that million mark. Now, as far as the vaccinations, statistically, 76.4% of the total U.S. population have received at least one dose, or 65% of the total population have been fully vaccinated. So we're moving up a tiny, tiny bit since you and I talked last Friday. And then 49.9% of the total booster eligible population have not received a booster dose. So that's even particularly lower. The hospital admissions, good news, 30% decrease. The amount of cases, new cases, is also good news, 28.5% decrease, and the deaths have decreased by 8.9% compared to a week ago. So a little bit of bright news, and of course, you know what's happening around the country. The mask mandates in a lot of places have come off, and you know, it's now optional for people what they want to do.
Right. Yeah, we're seeing a lot of relaxation with that here in Vermont as well, and numbers aren't jumping up. So hopefully the Omicron wave is on its way out completely.
I hope.
Yeah, and maybe some normalcy will return. Not so much in Ukraine. And the latest news, there are Russian claims of U.S. chemical weapon plants in Ukraine. Bob, what's that all about?
Well, Russia is now putting out the propaganda for their own benefit, of course, Rick, that we have supplied chemical weapons. The next thing you're going to hear is that we, through us, the Ukrainian government has used chemical weapons on the Russians. Therefore, the Russians are going to use chemical weapons on them. Putin has a history of it. He had a history of it, in Syria. He helped Bashar al-Assad. Assad cover up the use of chemical weapons against his own people. So I think that most likely he's going to attempt to use chemical weapons. And of course, he will say, I had to. Just like Russian soldiers who are going in thinking that they are liberating the people from President Zelensky, who's, quote, a Nazi. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the propaganda they've been fed. But, you know, anybody that bombs maternity hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, hospitals in general, apartment buildings, which is what Putin is doing massively, they don't care about any form of the truth.
Yeah. And as far as the chemical weapons plants, I know from what I understand, China is reporting that as well. So kind of taking the Russian propaganda machine and spewing that right out as fact throughout China.
Right. And China, of course, has fixed its technological algorithms on the net so that it's all pro-Russian propaganda internally within the country of China.
Very interesting. How has Russia widened the attack on Ukraine, Bob?
Well, the Ukrainian officials were reporting airstrikes. Now, this is their time, Friday, of course, their, you know, time difference with us, near the airports in the western cities of Ivanko, Frankivich, and Lutsk, and more bombings in the eastern city of Dnipro, where at least one civilian was reported killed. So they're widening their net. They had a convoy, Rick, of like 40-some vehicles headed to the capital, and it sort of dispersed and then started to go around other areas. So it's really Russia's trying to widen its net of the bombings and the, you know, troops on the ground, obviously.
And still facing a spirited response from the Ukrainian forces and people?
They are. I mean, Ukraine is really putting up a good fight. Poland is of great assistance. Of course, the world is in, except for China, is in against Russia with sanctions, and that's the type of thing you do need. That's how apartheid, you know, came undone, because the world got into it. So that's a positive thing. And, of course, the United States Congress acted and the Senate followed through, and the president, with cutting off, you know, our use of Russian oil and more additional sanctions. So that's happened. About 20,000-some people from around the world have began to volunteer to go to the Ukraine. 6,000 Americans have made inquiries into the embassy of the Ukraine, which is in Georgetown section of Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and they are screening people. It's voluntary. Ukraine is not paying people to come over and help them.
Oh, my. All right. This is a good reason we have you on each week, is to kind of understand some of the things that happens in Washington. And there's a big omnibus spending bill that got approved. So the rest of humanity has no idea what that means, Bob. So translate for us what it is, what's important about it.
I kind of, after serving 11 years there, you know, I kind of love the fake fainting, I'll call it, of people that are like, oh, I didn't know, you know. The speaker, really, you've got to give Speaker Pelosi credit. She divided the omnibus bill. Now, this is how the government's funded. And I do want to be candid about this. The sure. Congress does not do budgets. If anybody's congressman tells them we passed the budget, they didn't. They do omnibus packages that basically, you know, do temporary measures. Budgets haven't been done in probably 14 years, where you actually go through 13 appropriation bills, the entire process, and then you have a budget and it goes to the Senate. So these are omnibus bills. It's a different way to pass it. But the speaker split it into two parts. So you have, in just kind of layman's term, you have the omnibus bill with all the domestic policy issues in there, mm-hmm. you know, with additional money for Pell Grants, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have the omnibus bill that deals with defense spending. So she split it in half, and the people who, mostly Democrat, who do not like the defense side, voted against it, but there were enough Republicans and enough Democrats to pass it. Mm-hmm. So then the next vote comes up on the domestic spending, which most of the Republicans were against. So the Democrats voted for domestic spending and a few Republicans, and you've got the domestic spending bill. Now, it went to the Senate, and shockingly, the Senate just went, okay, you know. And well, you know, so something's changed there. But there's a lot in it. There's emergency spending, $13.6 billion in emergency spending for the Ukraine. And then, of course, like I said, some Pell Grants. There's some reauthorizations of the Violence Against Women Act, the National Flood Insurance Program, temporary assistance for needy families. There's a livestock reporting program and a lot more items that are in it, you know, language on extension of higher Medicaid reimbursements for U.S. territories, and on and on and on, because that's what omnibus means, mm-hmm. which you and I will be reporting on things we find out about in the next month or two.
Sure.
I did want to mention something kind of interesting, if I mm-hmm. could, Rick.
Yeah, please.
There are $4.2 billion in earmarks. Now, think about this. This is why the votes came. And 60% of the $4.2 billion is directly in the hands of Democrat lawmakers to put it into the bill, to earmark.
Sure.
I'm going to do this earmark for the state of Vermont. You know, I'm going to earmark a highway or whatever you're going to do. Now, 40% went to Republican districts. So, you know, it was kind of a nice split. Now, the earmarks are very, very controversial, and you'll read articles, you know, about how this leads to corruption, but I think overall, if somebody puts an earmark in, put their name in it, make it public, who's earmarking it. But, you know, who better knows, for example, what the state of Vermont needs? You know, I think the lawmakers from Vermont would, and the locals. So, I mean, personally, I know people don't like it. They call it pork, but I always had supported it.
All right. And, Bob, another thing I want to ask you about is President Biden's Bitcoin executive order. What is this, and why did he issue it?
This one scares me because I am Bitcoin illiterate. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's probably one of the reasons it scares me. Also, I have friends who said, Bob, get into Bitcoin. And now they're like, Bob, do you have any jobs available? Because they've lost all their money. And but he has issued, our president, an executive order on crypto, and it was issued and it really wasn't what a lot of people expected. So, in fact, the big they call them blockchain big hitters, like Winklevoss twins, whoever they are, applauded it online. So what it has The president's calling on government agencies to explore, just explore, the pros, cons, and possibilities of the digital coin situation, assets, business, you know. And he wants to look at consumer safety, environmental impact, and digitizing the dollar. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. It scares me. It's okay to look into this. That's fine. But it scares me if the United States government got into Bitcoins.
Yeah.
They haven't had the best track record on handling the greenbacks we have.
Good point. And the environmental impact is an interesting point because what it takes to run the computers, run the blockchain that backs up the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is pretty massive. So getting more information.
I'm going to make you my crypto advisor. I didn't know you know what you're talking about.
That's about the extent of what I know. But
okay.
It's the we'll learn together over the next next year. We'll see what happens. National correspondent Bob Ney, thanks for your time. We always appreciate having you on the show.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, we're going to go to a break and then return to talk with Colin Flanders of 7 Days about some Southern Vermont newspapers with a special connection to Ukraine. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Last year, the sale of several newspapers in Southern Vermont raised some eyebrows because of the individual who purchased the Bennington Banner, the Brattleboro Reformer, and the Manchester Journal. With the invasion of Ukraine by Russia on February 24th, the papers and its owners are in the news again. Colin Flanders wrote about it in this week's 7 Days. He joins us now to talk about it. Colin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Colin, let's take a step backwards to last year when these papers in Southern Vermont were purchased. Who was it who bought them?
Sure. So the new owner of the papers, his name is Paul Bellegor. He made his fortune in the largely unregulated foreign currency market, and he launched two Boston companies in the 1990s and then ventured into Vermont following the Great Recession. And over the last handful of years, he spent more than $3 million buying up these businesses and properties across the southern part of the state. He now owns a brewery, a real estate company, a maple syrup realtor. He even has this 1,500-acre plot in his hometown of Skilford that he's turned into a summer destination known as Viking Village. And so I think very quickly people can realize that when you hear some of these things, especially in some of these smaller towns, people start to wonder who this guy is.
Yeah, I forgot about Viking Village. It makes my heart go pitter-pat. Did people know much about him before he started to buy up all these things down in southern Vermont?
They didn't. He largely wasn't a known figure. He had a pretty scant even online presence. After the purchase of the newspapers, though, there were a few media stories written in depth about him, trying to figure out sort of what everyone else was. Who is this guy? And I think over the last year, people have gotten to know Paul a little more, both through his public statements, through some stories in the newspaper. But I think there still is a bit of suspicion about who this guy is, what his plans are, what his motivation is in the southern part of Vermont.
Well, what kind of businesses does he own elsewhere outside of Vermont?
Yeah, he owns a lot of things. I think some of the more interesting ones is he owns a few European companies. He has a soccer team in Bulgaria. He also owns a hotel over there. He owns a few other companies. And the one that I wrote about in this piece is a software development company that employs about a few dozen people in Ukraine. And that's his connection to the conflict.
Now, have there been many noticeable changes at the papers since Paul Bellegor took them over?
I think up until now, he's largely been a hands-off owner, at least as far as what I've been told. But over the last few weeks, I think the changes you can see in the paper are pretty clear, especially on the websites. He has been encouraging the papers to cover the Ukraine war because of his personal connections over there. And I think that this seems to be one of the most prominent times where his influence is being felt in the paper. Though I will admit that I haven't been reading these papers that closely over the last year, so I wouldn't want to act like I'm too much of an expert on that. But as far as I can tell, up until now, he has played somewhat of a hands-off role.
Now, tell us about a piece that ran with the headline, "War is the Answer," that Paul Bellegor wrote.
So this piece came out a few days before the Russian invasion. But at this time, I mean, I think people can remember the U.S. government was warning that an invasion was imminent. And while a lot of people still didn't think it was a possibility, when the piece ran, it was pretty shocking. So in the story itself, Paul doesn't say as explicitly as the headline might suggest that he thinks, for example, Russia should invade, or he thinks that the U.S. should join the war. What it is this kind of cold economic calculus of what would happen if a war were to occur over in Europe, a war that is now occurring. And what he argues is that the U.S. would benefit politically and economically. The way that he views it is that the only way that countries can really remain relevant in the modern age is to either excel at everything or make sure that other countries can't. I mean, he thinks that a war in Europe that didn't include U.S. troops would sap a lot of their resources. And in the same way that the U.S. Emerged in the wake of World War II, it would reestablish the country as a superpower.
Has he explained why he wrote this particular piece, a rather provocative piece? And what's been the reaction of readers of the paper?
So I talked to Paul about this. He did. I asked him about this. I asked him about the headline. I think that his explanation is probably not satisfactory to a lot of readers down there. I mean, what he told me is that he just thought it would be interesting to help people understand what the results of this war could be. I mean, he said, a direct quote to me was, "It's just economics 101, economics of war, who benefits, who loses." It seems like he views this in a bit of a professorial role. He's just trying to help readers understand how world economics works. I think that there's a lot of skepticism about that. Not only is that just kind of a weird thing on its own, but I think you have to keep in mind that this is a pretty liberal part of the state, especially down in Brattleboro. I mean, this is an area that's well known for its pacifist ideals, for protests of previous wars. And I talked to a few readers down there who really took issue with Paul's commentary and the headline in particular, which I know that Paul himself had put forward. They just felt like it was callous. They didn't really understand the point of it. They didn't know why he wrote it. And I think when I explained to him what Paul had told me, it only made them a little more confused.
Yeah, Brattleboro, outside of Burlington, probably the most progressive part of the state. You mentioned, you know, that the papers have been publishing more content and it coming directly from Ukraine. So what is the source of this information in Ukraine?
Yeah, so of the few dozen workers that Paul employs over there, a handful of them have been working directly with his newspaper, serving as what was described to me as sort of a secondary IT team. And these men have been funneling information straight from Ukraine to the Southern Vermont newspapers. They've been largely just calling videos from social media that they're finding and sending it along. The paper is then trying to vet those videos as best they can and then publishing them online. I mean, it doesn't seem to be a lot of firsthand content. It's more just things that they're seeing in their social media feeds, their networks. Although the papers have started writing some original content as well. They've covered a few of the men themselves. They've written about their stories. They've also written about Bellegor's attempts to remove some of his people out of the country. So it's this kind of multifaceted blitz of war coverage that's been happening out of the daily paper.
And these videos, what's the content of some of these videos that have been put on the websites of these newspapers?
Yeah, a lot of these videos are showing, they're showing scenes of war. There's videos of Ukrainian soldiers firing shoulder rockets at Russian tanks. Another video that I mentioned in the story shows a man standing in a doorway of a train as it's being boarded, and he's threatening people with a knife. And the challenge here is that news organizations across the world are really struggling to sift through what has become this sort of smokescreen of misinformation surrounding the war. And it's a big challenge, especially for a small paper like this, halfway across the world, to sift through these and figure out what's real, what they can be sure isn't some sort of misinformation. And that's something that I pressed them on a bit. I mean, the editor over there sort of acknowledged that with 100% certainty, they cannot say that this, what they're sharing hasn't been created by propagandists, but they felt that there deserved to be a sharing of these images with the rapidly unfolding humanitarian crisis. So it's sort of a risk calculus that they're taking.
Wow. Has this affected their social media hits? Have they seen a jump since they've been posting this kind of information?
Yeah. So, I mean, it does seem to be drawing interest. When I did a bit of a survey of the Brattleboro Reformer's Facebook posts, the posts about Ukraine have been generating some interest. I mean, I'm just basing that on likes and shares and things like that. And the initial story about Paul Beligor's staff in Ukraine was viewed around more than 20,000 times in just 2 days, which is a pretty large lump of traffic for a small newspaper like this. I mean, it's not surprising. This is the biggest story in the world right now. A lot of people are paying attention to it. And so when you see it come up in your feed, you're obviously interested. So they seem to be getting some interest.
And Colin, are you planning a week at Viking Village in Guilford, Vermont anytime soon?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I might have to wait for it to warm up a little bit, but I wouldn't be opposed. Maybe I'll come back after I do that.
I want to read that story, and I want to see a full photo spread of what Viking Village is all about. It sounds like a perfect Vermont getaway. You can read Colin's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Colin, thanks so much for being on this morning.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break for the news, and then we'll return to speak with Economic Development Commissioner Joan Goldstein. We'll be talking more again about ARPA funds. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. We've devoted a bit of time this week discussing the ARPA funds that are coming Vermont's way. It's a large windfall for the state and can help in critical areas that could use attention. So it is time well spent understanding what Governor Phil Scott has recommended to the legislature. The final area that we'll discuss is business and economic development. And here to take us through this proposed part of allocations is Economic Development Commissioner Joan Goldstein. Commissioner Goldstein, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you for having me. Thanks. Glad to be here, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have questions or suggestions about how this part of the ARPA money should be allocated, you can call us 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Joan, what are the key areas that your department oversees for the state?
Sure, that'll be great. So let me give some perspective so people have an understanding. Before COVID, our department would work on Vermont Training Program grants or any type of effort to help incentivize growth of business and growth of workforce development in the state. And on a typical year, we may give out maybe about $3 million in incentives and about $2 million in workforce development grants. There's a variety of other federal grants we work with. COVID hit, and the enormous sums of money that came to the state, plus the enormous strain that businesses were under, changed the dynamic considerably. To give a frame of reference, in 2020 with Coronavirus Relief Fund, we distributed, along with tax, $330 million worth of business relief. That was for businesses and nonprofits. And with the passage of the ARPA bill last year, you know, Vermont received over $2 billion in 21. The governor had a vision about what to do with these funds, and this is really an unprecedented time, not just for the state, but also for economic development.
Yeah.
Again, we typically had small sums of money to try to do something with, to try to change the trajectory. But now with the federal, you know, funds, we are able to do something. So last year, the legislature and the governor, we agreed on a couple of buckets. One was to continue to assist businesses in the economic recovery program. There were still businesses suffering. This is a crisis like none other. Even when the restrictions went away, still people's behavior patterns changed. They may not be going out to dinner as much or congregating as much. So there's still businesses suffering, and we provided a grant program to help them. The other thing, which was a real change in our direction, was to use some of this one-time money for capital investments. And again, this is not something that we've had funds for before. And the federal guidance is very, very strict, and it gives, you know, strict parameters on how to spend those funds. But at the end of the day, arts and entertainment venues, childcare facilities, museums, food suppliers, these all are projects that could help bring us back from where we were at the onset of the pandemic. And so we are in the midst of processing that. We got $10.5 million for the capital investment program. The governor did propose $90 million, and we received about $90 million worth of applications. So we are in the process of taking those applications through the paces so that we could, you know, make some good. In those applications are childcare facilities and, you know, things that we would typically not have the ability to do. So
yeah.
This was great. The trickling effect, though, of ARPA, so there's ARPA money, and then there's also general fund. The coffers were doing much better because of all the federal assistance. So the effect that it had on general fund revenues, again, we were able to implement into the general fund as Brownfield Redevelopment Fund, and also a technology-based economic development program. These are things we wouldn't typically be able to do. And what does that mean? We could take underutilized properties, redevelop them, help fund that, you know, brownfield or contamination mitigation, remediate it so it can go back to productive use. This has enormous impact on the coffers of the individual towns where those sites are located. Technology-based economic development program, another one. This is where we want to plant the seeds for the future so that when the university or somebody else has an invention or an idea or an innovation, they can get federal funding to help spur that on. So we are developing a program to help that. That was general fund money, but again, I don't think the general fund would be in as good of shape as it is without having the generosity of the federal government. The other thing we worked on was recruitment of workers. We were able to do more relocated worker program and remote worker program. As we know, Vermont has become incredibly attractive. Again, our handling of the pandemic, the governor's guidance in terms of, you know, all of the health precautions and vaccination rates. So people wanted to be here. It's normally an attractive place to go, and it became even more attractive.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are all the things that the department has become, you know, really a place of innovative new programming and trying to make use, most efficient use of these funds coming in so that we could expect yield in years to come.
Now, one of the things that the governor has suggested is the Grand List Enhancement Program. And this is one that I wouldn't typically think of when discussing economic development. So explain what the program is and how this would benefit the economic development of the state.
Yes, that's great. I'm so glad that you brought that up. I did just talk about the things that we asked for last year. And this year, we're asking for $50 million in capital investment, $30 million in Grand List, and $20 million in a VITA forgivable loan program. So the Grand List, so let's talk about Grand List. So when you think about economic development, you think, what is the object of the game, right? The object of the game is prosperity, and how could each individual Vermonter be prosperous? And what about the towns that they live in? How do they collect their revenue so that they could operate and provide services? So the Grand List is really a measure of that prosperity. And economic development efforts should work toward the increase of Grand List. Now, the thing where it gets complicated and a little bit askew is that we all think, oh, well, prices of homes are appreciating. Well, that's one thing. Okay, that's fine. What we wanted to do and what we found out through tax department is, let's find out, has the Grand List appreciated from a pure development perspective? In other words, are we adding to the pie as opposed to just appreciating for the limited properties that are available in a particular town? And what we found was an enormous amount of towns had less than 1% Grand List growth over a period of 10 years. It's an extremely disturbing stat, right? For anybody in economic development and anybody in Vermont. Typically, it just speaks to a stagnation. So we thought, all right, well, capital investment generally is a property redevelopment. Generally, there's obviously some other CapEx that wouldn't involve property redevelopment. So we thought, let's make sure we could help these towns. When you look at the list, there's a lot of correlation. Some of these towns, most of the towns, are rural. Most of them probably have broadband issues. Most of them are probably one-acre towns. There's a lot of correlation here about why they're not growing or why they're not in demand or where people want to live. So we need to change that trajectory. And we thought, even though it really is a capital investment program sort of subset, because, again, in order to increase Grand List, you need to improve your properties. So we thought, let's single that out and make sure that we make this program targeted to those towns that are suffering this declining or Grand List stagnation.
And how would that work? I mean, how will towns use this money? How much would they get? And then how does it benefit them?
Okay, so let me be clear about that. So really what it is, it's for the property owner or developer. So it's not that the municipality applies. It's that if, let's say, I want to do a project and I pick one of these towns as where I want to develop, I would apply for the funding. And the funding would come from this ARPA funds, and we would analyze what the as-complete appraisal value, the incremental appraisal value, or the incremental full list of that full listed value. So in other words, what does this project do? How will this project assist in the Grand List growth? And we would pay an increment, a percentage of the increment. That is the thought process of how we would pay on these projects, because if we do nothing, the fear is that it will just continue in that trajectory. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And let's take a call from Plainfield. Talk to Michelle. Good morning, Michelle.
Hi. So I have a question for Secretary Goldstein. I'm not sure if she's the right person to answer it, but I just heard that Plainfield, I may have this wrong, is getting $188,000. First of all, that's so much money. And you need a lot of input from people, and that's a lot of work. So and also, at the same time, our town clerk is retiring and says her job is, she's been terrific, but she says two people need to do the job, and we're missing, we don't have people in, crucial road, there are various crucial positions in the town that are paid, but no one is doing them, they don't have the workers, and so I guess one question is, can this money be used to raise salaries of some of the town workers? That's one of my questions. And the other is there going to be, what kind of oversight will be of this money? Because I've worked in several nonprofits in which there was embezzlement because it was so easy. Everybody trusted everybody.
Well, Michelle, let's get this to Joan Goldstein. I think Joan, what Michelle was referring to is money that's coming directly to municipalities as opposed to the ARPA money we're talking about. But can you explain to her some of what that money is all about that's going directly to Plainfield?
That'll be great. Thanks for – there's a lot in the question. So
yeah.
Let me try to unpack some of it. But
okay.
Yeah, my recommendation on the Plainfield, what are they going to do with the $188,000? Indeed, that's the municipal portion, not the state fiscal recovery fund. So the Vermont League of Cities and Towns have been helping towns analyze what they should do, how they should do it, how to stay compliant within the rules. So I would recommend that that's precisely what the town administration should do. As for folks retiring and not getting workers, that is a terrible phenomenon that we've been experiencing all across Vermont and actually all across the country. And I think, you know, we have to get creative. Will towns get together and share resources? I don't know the likelihood of that, but, you know, we have to start those conversations. But I would say the first thing is to consult with Vermont Leagues of Cities and Towns or the Regional Planning Commissions. Both of those bodies have been working with towns to help sort that out. Because, yes, even though there's money coming, we want to make sure you're optimizing it for the best reasons.
Absolutely.
The best outcomes.
Yeah, it is amazing. All our wee tiny, you know, villages and towns with so many volunteers helping in things like select boards, school boards, volunteer fire departments. It is amazing that we are able to operate all these wonderful little places, but it does tax those who have been putting in years in those positions. Now, I do want to get back to the state ARPA funds. And, Commissioner, $50 million would be for the capital investment program. So let's dig deeper into that, you know, what that would fund, how you would ascertain where the specific dollars go.
Yeah, so the ARPA rule dictates kind of where we could spend the funds. And part of those parameters include things like which industries were most severely impacted. And when we look at the list, it's really arts and culture and restaurants, food and accommodation services, that type of business. What types of services have suffered, so childcare or food supply. There are a number of different segments. So we would look for those projects that are in the most severely impacted industries or for the businesses that are operating within what they call qualified census tracts. There are a few around the state where there's already a problem with either unemployment or low or higher poverty rates than the rest of the state. So those are the parameters loosely, you know, that we would have to look at. And then we would look at each individual application to look about things, the readiness of the project, right? Because it is capital investment. We know that permitting and the whole process takes a while. And these funds have to be obligated by December of 24. So we have to be cognizant of the readiness of the applicant. We have to be cognizant of, did they raise funds elsewhere? We don't want to be the sole funder. We typically require a 50% match. So those are the types of projects. And you know, we were surprised at the volume of projects that came in. We are unable to fund general economic development projects. These have to be kind of recovery or people that were impacted by the pandemic, and that needs to be proven out. Like, you know, what are their financials? What was the impact? What was the impact on a project that might have been midway? So there are a number of areas that we'd have to look at. But we do think that by getting this appropriation, we can get to work right away and start that process, make sure that there's a path to completion. The funds have to be obligated by 24, but also have to be spent down by 26.
Mm. My first interview this morning was with Meg Smith of the Vermont Women's Fund. And when I think about economic development, I think about the need to bolster women-owned businesses, BIPOC-owned businesses, LGBTQ-owned businesses. Are there provisions being made in the dispersal of funds from these ARPA monies to address these specific needs?
Yes, in fact, there's another bucket of money I didn't talk about, which is something that's coming directly to the state from ARPA, but not state fiscal recovery funds, and that is called the State Small Business Credit Initiative. The state will get close to $59 million, and we will be working with VITA to do a small loan program as well as a venture capital program. And in that is an incentive to help what they're saying is socially and economically disadvantaged individuals. And we will be able to show that we'll be able to fit that bill. Additionally, we are working with Susanna Davis of Division of Racial Equity to convene the BIPOC group of businesses to really learn how do we best serve this community. If we're not serving them now, or if we are, how do we improve that? What is it that they are requiring that we're not currently serving, so that we could learn a little bit better about how to either do preferencing or set aside? You know, there's a variety of different ways that we could focus on that. But a combination of the monies that are coming to the state in a non-competitive fashion, I think will allow us to hit the ground running.
Commissioner, we have a couple minutes left. Any specific area of this allocation for business and economic development we haven't talked about yet that you want to make sure is highlighted?
Yeah, we haven't talked about the forgivable loan with VITA, and I think that's an important thing for businesses that are out there that are still suffering from the impact of pandemic and did not get either enough funding from the first couple of rounds of financing. This forgivable loan will be important for them. They still have working capital needs. They could apply to VITA if legislature goes through. Right now, this is in Senate, and hopefully will get passed out soon and go on to House. But this should help those if they are still suffering. This money could go toward operating expenses of the business, and as long as they've spent it on that, the loan could be forgiven. So we think that we're covering all bases, the short-term needs and the long-term building blocks. And it also intersects with the work of A&R, with our water wastewater project, with the broadband initiatives. All of it really intersects around economic recovery and economic development.
Joan Goldstein is the state's Economic Development Commissioner. You can learn more about Governor Scott's ARPA proposal at governor.vermont.gov/ARPA. Commissioner Goldstein, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. That is our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Now, our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can write to us to suggest topics or guests. And, of course, you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com, the Vermont Viewpoint podcast, sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Zingari. I'll meet you back here on Monday when we get a State House update. We're going to hear about the Vermont Small Business Development Center, and we'll also learn about HARP therapy.